sometimes being right means being alone. And the first time I really heard that is I had a really difficult decision I had to make around this program that was the largest one within Dell. I mean, we were spending like $100 million plus on it. And I came to the realization that we were going to implement this thing. It was going to cost us almost $1 billion and it wasn't going to work. And it was the brainchild of a predecessor who had had my position.
You are now listening to the podcast where authors inspire listeners to become authors, the Going North Podcast. I'm your host, certified self-leadership trainer, best-selling author, and book enthusiast, Dom Brightman. And you're going to be listening to a different author that will inspire you to join the business of immortality, known as authorship. Now let the fun begin. Today's episode is sponsored by book number two from Dominic Dom Brightman, Stay the Course, The Elite Performer's 7 Secret Keys to Sustainable Success. It is the field guide to help unleash the elite performer that is inside of you. Cop it today on Amazon.com or heading over to DomBrightman.com and snag it in book, ebook, and audiobook. So that way you can take it on the go and get yourself on the go to your northbound success. And today on the Highlight Reel Builder for Authors, known as the Going North Podcast, we got another super special awesome human for you today. Courtesy of my good buddy, Mr. Mickey Mickelson, all the way from the great country of Canada. Oh, that's right, indeed. I forgot which part of Canada, but I'm going to say Canada. We're going with it. You know him. You love him. He does great work because we got a great guest, my friends. That's right, indeed, because you're going to be in for a treat that's good enough to eat five times over, y'all, because we got one heck of a guest for you. He's an award-winning, you're that right, folks, an award-winning book cast, y'all, because not only has my man joined the business of immortality for his wonderful book, Passion Struck, he's also an award-winning podcast host as well, and he's also a U.S. Navy veteran, keynote speaker, entrepreneur, and the CEO of Passion Struck. Let's give it up for the JRM himself, John R. Miles. How are you doing today, John?
Hey, Dom. It's so awesome to be here. And I forgot Mickey was the one who set this up, so I'll have to thank him.
Hey, you got a lot of hours of the fire, so it's easy to forget stuff.
Absolutely.
Oh, man, that's what I'm talking about indeed. But hey, as with all introductions, it's not allowed to be 80 days long, and I probably forgot some things. So my goodness, if you were to define your life journey to the John that you are today in three words, what would they be and why?
Becoming passion struck. And I would describe why is up until about 4 years ago, the phrase passion struck didn't even exist for me. But I was talking to a good friend of mine and we were having this discussion and I said, you know, so many people find themselves stuck in life for one reason or another. And then it's like they rebirth this new version of themselves with where they find a cause that is so compelling to them that they're willing to risk it all to go after it. They're willing to put their finances at risk, their relationships at risk, their career at risk, because they found something so important that they need to start impacting it. And he said, it sounds like you're talking about someone who went from being stuck to becoming passion struck. And to me, that was it. And it's this ongoing process, you could say, of becoming your most self-realized version of who you are. So becoming passion struck.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about today. That's what I'm talking about today. Hey, yeah, it's so true, D, because, yeah, passion will make you do some crazy things. Yeah. And the good news is, this is about the good passion, not the romantic passion. I remember one Amazon reviewer from somewhere thought this book was about love or said it was about love or something. Like romantic.
Oh, my gosh. You know, that was one of the first reviews that was done. And I'm reading this review and I'm just sitting here going, that fool has never read my book. Because you're right. It's like Passion Struck is about this relationship that these two people have and how they are so struck with each other. I'm like reading this. This is a whole load of garbage.
Yeah, because when I caught that, I'm like, wow, okay, all right. Is that the new craze now, reverse reviews? You assume yes. Everything?
Well, I'll tell you what is really a bit disappointing to me is how many reviews you end up seeing, and it as if they go to the Amazon page, take the verbiage that you have, put it into AI, and then spit out whatever verbiage they're going to use. And I see this across all reviews now. And to me, I obviously want the human version of these and people who have actually read the book because of the other ones don't really mean anything.
Yeah, you can say that again. Well, speaking of book, my goodness, what helped you to finally get across the finish line to finally get your book out, man? Like, congrats on all the success that has gotten. I think the book's only, what, a month old at the time of this recording, too?
It came out in February, so we're now about 4 months old.
So there we go. That's that time thing we were talking about before the recording.
Yeah. But I'm super psyched it's finally out. At the onset of this process, I guess I never really thought of myself as an author before I went in this. But then I started to talk to people and realized I've really been an author my whole life. I've just been writing more business type of writing because that's what my career was. But every time you're having to write board papers or a proposal for a new project or a strategy document or a position paper, any of those things you're writing, I just now get to be much more creative with it, which is something that I love. So honored to have this book in the world and so thankful that it's already impacting so many people.
Impacting people indeed. Amen to that. That's what I'm talking about indeed. So what do you consider the biggest thing you learned about yourself through the whole process?
I had thought I had faced rejection a lot before I tried to become an author. And I think I touched just the tip of the iceberg because I have to tell you, the whole publishing industry is changing so much. I mean, not only with the self-publishing aspect of it, but the publishers don't really do much for you at all anymore to market the book. And I hate to say this, but it's almost as if they're more concerned with your platform and the size of it than they are the quality of the end product that is being delivered. Because when I started talking to agents, all of them, even before they really got into the book, we're saying, back at this time, you really don't have a personal brand. No one's going to want this. You don't have followers. You don't have anything that's going to amplify the book. And then how do you know anything you're writing about, since you don't have this personal brand, is even going to be received well from people who read it or hear about it? And as I think back upon it, they were right in many respects, but after going to 80 agents and being turned down by every single one of them, after a while, you feel like you're about the size of a thumbtack because you've been rejected so many times. But instead of letting those rejections stop me, I used it as fuel to really keep myself going and to prove them wrong and show myself that I could do it. So I realized that I didn't have an opportunity because I started this in COVID to really publicly speak because people weren't doing it. And we all know when you're on these virtual talks, you can't see the audience. So there's no way you can measure their response. So that's what really led me to start the podcast, because I thought it and a YouTube channel would be the only way that I could really try the content out and see how people en masse are responding to it.
And it took off like freaking wildfire, man. If I was thinking, what, 40 million downloads too recently?
Yeah, we have 40 million downloads. And I have to tell you, at first, I think it was, I had the same reception I hear from a lot of podcasters, meaning Remember my first few episodes, I had this optimistic view that I was going to get hundreds of listeners. And man, I couldn't even get my family members to listen to it. I had about maybe 20 or 25, and most of them were from people I didn't even know. And I think that's kind of how it goes for a lot of people, is we think we're going to have this big fan support from those who are closest to us. And you know, they listen to a few, but it certainly hasn't been the bulk of the downloads I've gotten. And I think for me, the hockey stick moment kind of started about 6 months in, when I became a much better podcaster, because I realized what I was doing is I had done so much research before I even started the podcast on other podcasts. And I just came to understand that I wasn't being my authentic self on the podcast. I was trying to emulate these other hosts. And so when I started to do this my own way with my own personality attached, asking the questions in the way I wanted to ask them, everything started to change and more people started to become attracted to the podcast. And I went from 25 downloads per week to, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000. And then it just kept climbing.
Today, climbing that you did and are still doing indeed. That's right indeed. That's right indeed. Anything else you learned from the podcasting has helped you become a better podcaster?
Well, certainly doing all the interviews has taught me a lot of things about, sometimes you get into a podcast and you have no connection to the person you're interviewing. And this is an interesting dynamic because it plays out when we meet people sometimes, when you just feel like you don't have a connection to them at all. But it also comes out that way, I'm guessing you found this as well, when you're interviewing people on these shows and you're just sitting here going, this is just not flowing well at all. What can I do to make this more interesting or better? So that's definitely something I've learned. And it's also been nice when you feel like something has just like hit a grand slam as you're doing the interview and everything comes together. The other thing it's really helped me with is public speaking, because I do a solo almost every week. And when you do that, it's almost as if you're having to write a keynote speech, because mine are typically 20 to 30 minutes in duration, and having to produce that content. Think about that as writing a chapter of a book, because that's about what it amounts to. And I've now done about 150 of those. So a lot of additional creative output comes from that as well. How about yourself? Does any of that resonate with you?
Oh, it resonates indeed. Yes, it does indeed. Because, yeah, it's like those, that 6 month period, the hockey stick moment you mentioned earlier, like it makes so much sense, because it seems like that seems to be like the magic amount of months after a while where things start coming together if you're consistent enough. Because that's when this show got a lot more popular, after 6 months of, hey, every Thursday, a new episode was going to be up. And kept a promise, and I don't know where these freaking PR companies come out of nowhere, but like, hey, can we have our author or our client on your show? I'm like, oh yeah, sure. That's the touristic title. And then folks start tuning in more. It's amazing how it all comes together when you're in a way passionate about something. Actually stick to it long enough, then you'll actually see some plants come out of the ground from all the seeds you're planting.
Yes. Well, and I think the other thing, the 6 month point does, is it gives confidence to a guest to be willing to come on the show. I won't go on shows that are brand new, because let's face it, the vast majority stop doing the show after 10 or 12 episodes. And to me, that 6 month point is like this magic inflection point, because that's when a lot of people give up. And I had put in my mind that I was doing this at least for a year, if not 18 months. And so giving up to me at 6 months wasn't an option. So it was just figuring out, what do I need to do differently to make it a better show and make more people want to tune in. And I'll tell you, when I go back periodically and I listen to the first 4 or 5 episodes, I just cringe at how bad it was compared to what it's like now.
Oh, yeah.
So if you're listening to this, do not go back to the first five episodes of Passion Show. Go to like episode 110 when it became a well-oiled machine.
Yeah, folks really have to dig if they really want to go back to the first five to be like, all right, let's go. Like, oh, no, this is not the same guy. This transformation is real.
Well, I'll tell you, the other thing that I have learned from this is you think that the big names are going to deliver the most downloads. And I haven't necessarily found that to be true because the big names tend not to promote the episodes at all. And I have found that your everyday heroes who have a loyal following are the ones who tend to get the most traction. Is that something you found as well?
Hey, you're so right about that. You're so right.
Yeah. The only anomaly that I had from that is the first big name who agreed to come on the podcast. And I have to tell you, this is a funny story. So I have loved Susan Cain's writing for years. Her book, Quiet, transformed my life because as an introvert in the Fortune 500 world, I was constantly an anomaly and trying to be an extrovert and didn't realize the superpower that was within me. So I had reached out to her because she had a new book coming out, never thinking that she would come on. And at the time, my daughter was helping me with the podcast to do some coordination. And this email comes in from her assistant that says, Susan has decided that yours will be one of the smaller shows that she's agreed to come on because she likes what your podcast is about. And my daughter writes back, well, that's great, but his schedule is completely full, so we're going to have to pass on this. And I just happened to see this exchange come across my phone about 5 minutes after she sends this email and quickly call up the assistant and say, I'm sorry, this was a complete mistake. Yes, I want Susan. And her interview luckily went on and it's become the most downloaded one I've ever had on the podcast. But getting interviews like that are so important because it really does open the door from a credibility standpoint for you to get not just big name people, but just people in general wanting to come to the show. Because I think they almost see that person who's been on the show, regardless of who it is, and then they see themselves in the company of them. So it makes more people want to join. So I still bring on the big names because you kind of have to, but my favorite episodes are really with the people who I find who are just making a difference in the world. Even if that's making a small impact, I like to highlight those stories because they're the ones that people don't know about. And they're oftentimes doing just amazing things that need amplification. So if I can help them do that, I feel like I'm doing a service to them and to humanity. So there you go.
So I'm talking about the days. I'm talking about the day. That's right. Three cheers for the hometown heroes, y'all. That's right, indeed. That's right, indeed, who have those great followers today. That's right, indeed. Because name of the game is making a difference. That's right, indeed. I wonder if that's actually that might be the life motto of one of our past guests and big fans of this show, Stanley McCloskey. It's one of his biggest things. He's always looking to make a difference indeed, and that's a wonderful thing to do, indeed. So my goodness, man, since you've been on both sides of the microphone, is there a question that you wish folks would ask you more often when you're on the guest side of the game?
I'm trying to think a question that I haven't been asked. I guess a good question would be, I had a traumatic brain injury when I was a kid, and how that has kind of influenced my life, because we often think about our circumstances when we're growing up, which side of the railroad tracks we're from. But what I've learned is that is not the determinant, because I could have been born in the White House, and after this traumatic brain injury, it wouldn't have mattered because I had to rebuild myself from scratch. And I think that this aspect of our personal agency to alter our lives is something that I think some people believe in, some people don't. Do we have the power of choice? Do we have the ability to influence where our life is going? And from my firsthand experience and many of the scientists and researchers that I have brought on the show, the unequivocal answer I get is that personal agency does exist. We have it within us to change our circumstances. So then the question becomes, why don't we? Why do so many of us just end up in a fixed state and don't break free from it? And I think that's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is. It's right indeed. It's right indeed. That's right. I guess.
And I think
getting passion struck.
Well, I think the answer is oftentimes we can't see what's beyond the horizon, and or we have a vision of what it could look like, but it's almost as if we're on top of a mountain and we're looking across to another mountaintop where we see nirvana and what we could be, but we don't see a clear connecting point to get from point A to point B. I mean, there isn't that nice rope ladder that's spread across from us to go from one point to the other. And I think that's where people's dreams halt, because since they can't see the path, they just stop. Instead of realizing if they just took one additional action, maybe that bridge would start visualizing in front of them. And to me, it's really this whole idea that we all have something called activation energy at our disposal. And activation energy is, it's almost as if you're looking at a matrix, and on one side you've got energy and on the other side you've got intentionality. I don't care what you're doing. When you're starting something new, you're going to be faced with an enormous force of activation energy. And so one of the things that I found is that the more you become accustomed to lowering the activation energy, the more that you can propel your life forward. And I just use this analogy. Imagine that you're in the car with your wife and she's pregnant, and all of a sudden the car runs out of gas before you get to the emergency room. You've got really two options. You can either sit there on the side of the road and try to thumb someone down, because imagine you don't have your cell phone with you. Or you can get behind the door and start pushing it. And if you take the second option, what's going to happen is that you're going to be faced with a ton of force against you. Activation is going to be very difficult. But once you keep pushing that car forward, the activation energy lowers, and eventually you hit a decline and you really pick up speed, etc. And the same thing goes with the actions that we take in life, the choices we make, and how they accumulate. And what I find is all you really need to do is pick a starting point. For me, I had a lot of past trauma, and so I needed to heal that trauma if I was going to go from being inauthentic about how I was approaching my life and stop being a victim of it to taking control. And what I find is the more you double down and you start making progress on it, it actually opens up paths to improvement in other areas of your life, because you're lessening the activation energy and you're becoming better at doing it. So it becomes easier to start doing other things that transform other areas. And to me, that is a core component of passion struck, but it's also a core component of, if you want to get out of the stuckness you feel, the circumstances you have, you got to pick the biggest issue that's keeping you stuck and start taking deliberate actions to overcome it. And they're going to be small at first. And I think that's where people make mistakes, is they think it has to be this huge change, and that's just not ever going to work.
So talking about indeed, so talking about indeed. That's right, that's right. Indeed, that's right indeed. That's right indeed. Y'all getting the good stuff today, y'all. That's right indeed. Y'all getting the good stuff today. Stuff that you need to put in your ears for like ever. That's right indeed. That three repeats, baby. That's right indeed. That's right indeed. So my goodness, man. Shoot, so having all that past trauma to where you're now today and being a U.S. Navy veteran, and if I'm not mistaken, with the CIO at Dell Corporation too, right?
Yeah, I was a CIO at Dell, yes.
Yeah, man, like, dude, that's like a huge testimony to others, like, hey, you can succeed no matter what happened in the past. And like you said, it's like what you do with what you have, it doesn't matter about the environment, really.
You know, the funny thing about being a CIO at Dell, and at the time I was there, that position was probably one of the top 10 most coveted CIO roles there was. But what I quickly learned is we had 150,000 employees at Dell when I was there, and about 149,999 think they can do a better job of being the CIO than you can. And about 100,000 of them were probably smarter than me too. So it is a difficult environment to walk into, because anytime you're in a technology organization, there are a ton of bright people. And so you really are a servant to them, and just trying to navigate the labyrinth of what that company had become by that point was really tricky. I remember when I first started, we had something like 8,000, 9,000 different applications. And I would say what we needed to have was about 1,000, because we had so many overlapping versions, because what ended up happening is the company went from Texas to global. And when they went global, everyone thought they should have their own tool differentiate themselves. Then they went back to kind of being Texas-centric, then it expanded again, and you went through these things. And what ends up happening is you create what I call accidental architecture or spaghetti architecture, because that's what all your systems look like, because you're doing Band-Aid after Band-Aid after Band-Aid, and it just makes future innovation extremely difficult, because after a while, all the people who put the Band-Aids in place end up leaving the company. And so now you've got a bunch of people who are not only learning these ancient systems, but they're trying to decode what the heck went on here and why did this person do this without understanding any of the background to it. So it's a lot more challenging than it appears.
I could imagine these. I could imagine these.
Yeah. And one of my favorite stories that I love telling about Michael Dell, because I have always really enjoyed being around him, especially in a one-on-one. He's very humble, very easy to talk to, and I have found very down to earth. And I remember we did this conference where our sales organizations hated it, because we brought in some of the world's largest CIOs. And what we were trying to explain to them is how Dell works. And we called it the Dell on Dell conference, because any acquisition that we would make, we would throw out whatever other technology we were using. We would use our own crap, which in itself was very difficult, especially if you're buying a storage technology that's supposed to be for a small, medium-sized business. And now we're running in an $80 billion business off of it. But in this conference, the salespeople weren't allowed to be there. So it was only the people who were in the technology group talking to their peer group, basically. And Michael would always come to this, and he would never make a big deal about it. He would just go out on the floor, was typically just wearing a t-shirt that had Dell on it and a pair of jeans and sneakers. And I remember I have these CIOs from two or three of the biggest companies in the world come up to me, and they go, "We just wanted to tell you that the next time you see Michael, we have to have you tell him about this employee that we met here today. He was talking to us about these new computer screens that you have, and this was when they were the rounded screen, and he knew everything about them, how they were made, why they were doing it. It was the most in-depth explanation I've ever heard." And I already knew who it was before I even looked. But I said, can you point me to who you're talking about? And they go, "That person over there in the white t-shirt." I go, "You mean Michael Dell?" And they're like, you're kidding me. I'm like, no, go tell them yourself. And that's just, and in his house, I have never been in this portion of the house, but I understand he has an underground kind of laboratory where all he does is, I mean, he's just a geek in heart, and he just goes down there and tries different things out. And he loves to talk about it. And I think it's one of the issues that comes with fame is, unfortunately, there were some death threats to him and his family members. So he had to have the security detail to protect him. I mean, he's got $30 billion. But I think for him, it was also difficult because he couldn't have the personal relationships that he would have liked to have, which was just being a normal person, which unfortunately won't ever be the case again. Anyway, hope the listeners like that story.
Freaking great story indeed. Sure, that's what I'm talking about. And that's really the kind of guy you want on top of your organization and your company like that. Because it's like, hey, they know exactly what they're selling, what they're dealing with technology-wise.
No, they do. And one of my favorite stories, another one of Michael that I wrote about in the book, was I have this chapter that's all about being a boundary magnifier. And what it really means is sometimes being right means being alone. And the first time I really heard that is I had a really difficult decision I had to make around this program that was the largest one within Dell. I mean, we were spending like $100 million plus on it. And I came to the realization that we were going to implement this thing. It was going to cost us almost $1 billion and it wasn't going to work. And it was the brainchild of a predecessor who had had my position before, who was now one of the people I was working directly for and was on the executive steering committee. And I went to Michael and I said, I've got this dilemma. You're going to keep hearing this is the solution that needs to get pushed, but we've done this independent evaluation and we're going to spend all this money and it is not going to work and it's not doing anything for the shareholders. And I said, what do you recommend doing? And he would not put his neck out on the line. That's just not the type of person he is. And he just looked at me and he said, sometimes being right means being alone and realizing the consequences of what it means to be right. And I ended up going in there telling him that we needed to cancel this program and that we could do it for much less. It ended up resulting in that president coming after me, doing everything he could to get me out of Dell, and he finally was successful. And then an interesting thing happened about 18 months later. The person who took over my role called me up on the phone and says, you're never going to believe what happened. We were just in the steering committee meeting, and now they had implemented this other solution that I had told them to do, and the CFO in the meeting, I guess, looks at these presidents who had not backed me and said, basically, you all are fools. Miles had it right all along. You should have listened to him and not let your ego get in the way. And didn't benefit me at that point, other to know that in my own heart, I had made the right decision. I knew it then. And to me, it's really that instance where you've got to stick up for your core values, even if doing the hard thing means that you're going to have consequences for doing it. Because I don't think, looking back, I could have lived with myself if I would have just gone with the popular group, knowing that this wasn't the right thing to do. But I mean, these things are hard lessons that you learn.
Hey, so right about that. So right about that. Sometimes got to be alone when you're right. But hey, part of the cost.
Yeah, it really is.
But hey, that's freaking good though, and that's a real display of leadership right there that folks need to keep in front of their minds. Like, hey, integrity is everything. But you know, that'd be the popular person, because everybody could be wrong.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Well, I think sometimes it's like what I was talking about, where you're trying to cross the chasm in your own life. I think sometimes it's so easy to see a solution like this where Oracle is a huge company. This is a proven solution. The alternate solution is using a whole bunch of new technologies that they haven't seen the proof points for. So it is much easier to make a decision when you're using something that has been proven. Unfortunately, what they neglected to look at was that the business model was changing rapidly and we were no longer going to be the Dell of the past. We were becoming a completely different Dell that needed new fundamental capabilities to do software sales and to do more bundling of our offerings. And the Oracle solution just didn't have that as a capability, and it wasn't even on their roadmap. So it was never going to work. But oftentimes it's hard to see that when you get so committed to the path that you're on and you don't want to change, which is the same thing that happens in life. And Adam, another area of the book that people don't really ask me about is the third portion of the book. And the way I wrote this is it has two sections that make up the Passion Struck framework. One section is six mindset shifts where I'm really guiding you on why you're crafting the life that you want, why you need to reinvent, why you need to confront your fears, look at things through a different perspective. In the next six principles, I go through behavior shifts, which is really what you do with your actions, and it influences how you do them. But the third portion of the book, I call the psychology of progress, is really the when and where you apply these principles in your life. And it really gets into how do you take action. I've given you the principles on how to do it. This really gets into how do you actually apply this to your life. And the big aspect that surprises me that more people don't ask me about is the whole third portion is really about how do you create a life of significance. Because I think we see today this rise in mental illness. We see this rise in people feeling lonely. We see the rise in people feeling helpless and hopeless. And so many people feeling unfulfilled by what they do. And I think all those things relate to an underlying crisis of significance. I think so many people wake up every single day and they get out of bed and they put their feet on the ground and they feel like nothing in their life matters. Like they're just going through the motions and they don't feel significant. And when you don't feel that in your life, of course you're going to feel like you're stuck, like you're helpless, like you're hopeless. And it is going to cause depression and anxiety because you start getting up and thinking, what is this all about? Why am I doing any of this? And that's at its core what I wrote Passion Struck to do, is to educate people that you can live a life of significance. And it starts with reinventing the very person that you are and living your life differently.
Yeah, that's right indeed. Living that life differently indeed. That's right indeed. That's right indeed. I just think different, but live different, y'all. That's right indeed. The good different. Have to be good to deal with the folks around you. Name of the game, don't put on a unicorn horn just to be different. If I poke my eye out, you'll go from passion struck to horn struck.
Yes. Don't want to do that.
It's like, yeah, they were too passionate about the unicorns. They took it too far. But hey, it's all good. It's all good. Well, speaking of Passion Struck, the wonderful book, Passion Struck, 12 Powerful Principles to Unlock Your Purpose and Ignite Your Most Intentional Life. If that book were a food, what would it be and why?
Man, you talk about a question I've never been asked before. I'd have to think about this one for a second. I'm going to say it's a Philly cheesesteak because I grew up in Pennsylvania, and when you take something as simple as the ingredients of a cheesesteak, you would think that replicating a perfect 10 cheesesteak would be pretty easy, but we both know that it is not. And it's as if we have all the ingredients to make it, yet we're not intentional about how we make it. And so even if we are using the same things that a 10 shop uses, it tastes differently. So what's the fundamental difference? I think this is the analogy to what Passionstruck is about, is we all have these innate tools in our toolkits. We're kind of given this same lease that we can use these tools to our disposal. But I think the difference between someone who just has these ingredients and can't make it compared to the person who can is that they have learned how to perfect it. And so one of that is they have gone through the learning process of how do you create the perfect sandwich, but they've also gone through the actions and the repetition that it takes to consistently make it time and time again. And I think the same thing equates to our life. We have these ingredients, but it's learning how to actually use them to propel ourselves forward. And then it's being consistent, which I think is the most important thing that people do not do, in taking the actions to put those ingredients into place and continuing to better and better and better it until you eventually, over time, reach perfection. And so that would be my answer.
That girls I'm talking about, indeed. I'm talking about, indeed. Funny enough, you're the first person to say Philly cheesesteak today. As it is.
There you go.
Because it's so right.
You can have I'm just saying it because I live here in St. Petersburg, and we just had this new Philly cheesesteak place open where they say authentic Philly cheesesteaks. We went in and got them, and it's maybe a 4 out of 10. And these folks are from Philly. And they've got all the ingredients, but it certainly doesn't taste like a Philly cheesesteak. So there you go. There's the gap.
Another reason why Passionstruck belongs on every bookshelf, dangummit. That's right indeed. That's right indeed. Put on your bookshelf and then use it for yourself. So that way it can be both shelf and self-help indeed. Because, hey, it's good stuff indeed. It's good magical stuff. And it's even good for your ears, too, since there's an audio version as well, which I appreciate.
Yeah, I wish someone would have told me how arduous it was to record your own book. That's a whole process in itself. But I'm very glad I did it. But going through it is not a very fun experience.
Mm-hmm. You question if you really know the English language. Like, I know I can say these words. Well, I have to repeat this again the seventh time.
Well, you know, there's something different, though, about reading your book in your head and reading it out loud. And as I was reading it out loud, I'm like, why in the world did I write it this way? That doesn't make sense. And that happened a number of times where I was just like, wanted to bat myself on the head because it did not come out as articulate as I had hoped. Or the other thing is sometimes I use two big words that I can't even pronounce. So that's also difficult when you got to sit there and try to pronounce the words 10 times to get it right.
Oh, yeah, it's real. It's real. I understand your pain is so true. It's like, oh, this is going to be a great idea. Oh, God. All right. Let me think this one over again next time. Oh, man. Well, we're coming down to the magical question that every guest gets to receive, and that is, if you were to wake up tomorrow and you were 25 again, but you're still in the current year, what advice would you give to yourself?
I love this question because I actually wrote this book and dedicated it to my two kids, one who turned 26 yesterday and my daughter's 20. Because I wanted to equip them with the lessons that it took me 30 years of my life to learn, and the lessons that after researching 750 other people who have become passion struck that they employed in their own life. And if there's a way to help them do a clearer path to becoming their ideal self. That is what I was hoping to give them. So in that same vein, I wish I had this book when I was 25, because it would have saved me so many mistakes and setbacks across the way of life that ended up benefiting me. But man, they're hard to go through. And it's nice to have a shorter path to get there if you can. And I think the other piece of advice I would have given myself is, I, knowing what I know now, I wish I would have written the book Quiet and been the person who originally put that in the world, because I wish at 25 I knew the power of being an introvert.
Sweep. That's what I'm talking about indeed. The introvert power's where it's at, yo. That's right indeed. That's right indeed. Don't have to be gregarious all the time. Sometimes you just have to be like, you know what? Like, I'll be in this corner right here, relax a bit, let me see what's going on first, and then slowly get myself out there a bit and be like, yep, there we go, I'm learning about you. That's right indeed. But what about you? Oh, no, what about you? Yeah, you, yeah, it's all about you, buddy. That's right indeed. He's heard that right, folks. It's good stuff indeed. Because, man, John's shared a good deal of information, and the good news is probably only been, 1.5% of it. So for those who need to dive into the other 98.5% of what my man John does and keep up with all that you're doing, what's the best way for folks to do so?
The best ways are visiting my two websites, passionstruck.com or johnmiles.com. There you can find everything. And if you're looking for a different podcast, would love for you to tune in to the Passion Struck podcast. It comes out Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays.
Well, there you have it, folks. Got to put a link to all of John's wonderful wares in the show notes. Be sure to cop some copies of Passion Struck and subscribe to his magical podcast as well, because it's some good stuff indeed. Just like this show, he's got heavyweights on his show as well, y'all. That's right indeed. Like, shoot. You're going to need to, like, go into a cave for, like, freaking, I don't know, probably, like, 6 months to catch you with all the goodness that my man's dropping over there. And then when you come out alive, like you're Moses from getting the Ten Commandments, you're going to need another 3 months because he's adding even more content to it. That's right indeed. That's right indeed. So be sure to subscribe to his magical show, got some copies of his books, and keep up with what he's doing, because he's only just getting started, y'all. I'm sure my man's got even more big things planned in the future. That's right indeed. Well, any parting words before we close up shop?
Well, I very much appreciate you and Mickey for having me on the show. And I think if there's anything I wanted a listener to realize, is that you matter. You hold so much significance in the world, and you were born to make a difference. So the best time to plant an idea is today. The best time to change your life into the one that you want is today as well.
If you're hearing this part of the episode, that means you're one cool individual. Thanks a bunch for tuning in, and if you enjoyed what you heard, be sure to share it with at least one other person in your network. Bonus points for 3. And be sure to check out the backlog too while you're at it, because there are hundreds of wonderful episodes to choose from as well.